Hello and welcome to a special interview with The Print. Today we have somebody who needs practically no introduction at all. A three-time MP from Thiruvananthapuram, former United Nations Undersecretary General, former Minister of State for HRD and External Affairs, and author of 25 books, Dr. Shashi Tharoor.
Hello,
welcome
Anand.
Good to the show.
Good to see you, Anand. Thank you.
So, my first question would be, when you came down to contest in 2009, that was 15 years ago, did you imagine that you would be the longest serving MP from Thiruvananthapuram?
No.
And that you would be running a fourth time?
Yeah, I never would have imagined that, Anand. In fact, when I first came, everything was new to me. I had not even voted in an election because I left India to go to graduate school in the States at the age of 19 at a time when the voting age was 21. So I was completely sort of, it's like the old joke about throwing a child into the swimming pool and he's learning how to swim by just having to survive. And that's how I got into politics. But now, it doesn't seem so odd anymore. First of all, Thiruvananthapuram is not just my karma bhumi. It's really become a home for me. Delhi, one is very conscious. One has a lot of friends. I've been to college there. But it's a sarkari existence. It's centered on parliament, on the party, on various activities in national politics. Thiruvananthapuram is home now, and this is where I will see out my final years, there's no doubt about that. And therefore, giving a chance to represent it once more is something I rather welcome. You're right, I'm already the longest serving MP because the only other MP to have won three terms.
Charles
unfortunately won one term for a very short
truncated
parliament,
yeah.
Less than 2 years. So he had less than 12 and I already have 15, so I got the record already. But having said that, it's not the record that matters. It's the quality of what you're able to do. And I had said in my very first election, I meant it very sincerely, that if I feel I'm no longer making a difference, I will step aside myself. No one will have to push me. I know that I've been able to do good work in very challenging circumstances the last 10 years. And therefore, I believe that the people of Thiruvananthapuram can continue to be well served. And I'm very confident now in any case that we're going to be able to unseat this government in Delhi. And therefore, what we can do through an India Alliance government will be even greater for the people of Thiruvananthapuram.
So let me take up from that. You're saying that India Alliance does have a chance to form the government. So, but the mood of the nation surveys and many other surveys say paint a completely different picture.
We simply cannot trust those surveys anymore, my dear Anand. We're looking at a situation where the reality is staring us in the face. Number one, 2019, the BJP maxed out in 9 states where they simply cannot win any more seats because there aren't any seats to win. Every seat they won in Haryana, in Gujarat, in Rajasthan, Uttarakhand, Himachal, Delhi. And they won all but one seat in Madhya Pradesh, all but one seat in two seats in Chhattisgarh, all but one seat in Karnataka, all but one seat in Bihar. You're looking at a phenomenal result in 2019, which it's impossible for them to replicate. In every state I've mentioned, with the possible exception of Gujarat, even that I'm not sure, but in every state I've mentioned, the India Alliance parties are bound to gain seats. In a place like Karnataka, there was a survey that came out 2 days ago of 17 seats for the Indian National Congress. In Telangana, a survey came out last week, 10 to 12 seats for the Congress. And we had one seat in Karnataka and two seats in Telangana. So you're looking at a result that is dramatically improved from our point of view from 2019. But for the BJP, the problem is this. The only way they can go is down because there's no way left to go up. Now, when they go down, two problems start happening. And the proof of this, by the way, I'll first say what the two problems are. The first problem is they will lose their majority. The second problem is that some of the internal dissent in the BJP that has been clamped down upon because the leadership keeps winning, that will start bubbling forth as well. This is why I think in sheer panic, we have seen three different phenomena happening in the last 10 days, which have convinced me that the BJP knows they're losing. Number one is the desperate search for allies. Allies they had kicked out of the NDA with contempt in the previous occasion. They are desperately wooing them back. They were successful with Chandrababu Naidu, but they had to swallow the fact that he had initiated a no confidence motion against them in parliament and used terms of abuse for the prime minister personally. And they've forgiven him and brought him back. But they failed with the Akali Dal of having tried to negotiate with them. The Akali Dal, which had stepped aside during the farmers movement and is conscious of the continued disgruntlement of farmers, the Akali Dal has pulled back and said they will not join them. And even more dramatically, Odisha, where the BJP, unfortunately, let it be known in the public, they were even willing to surrender seats they had won last time to the BJD because they needed an alliance so desperately. Mm. Naveen Patnaik has said no alliance, and that's off the table. So you're looking at, number one, a desperate search for allies. Number two is the panicky move of freezing the Indian National Congress's bank accounts. Some of the tax charges against the Congress go back 30 years. According to the media, they were made inquiries about the tax returns of 93, 94 yes. of the Indian National Congress. Now, this is absurd. And I'll come to the third one, Arvind Kejriwal's arrest at midnight. Now, all of these things suggest a level of panic and concern that convinces me the BJP knows what the media doesn't seem to know, which is that they're losing. On the question of both Kejriwal and the Indian National Congress bank accounts, one simple question. Both of these pertain to investigations covering a period of years or going back, the investigation themselves going back for several years. Could they not have waited 2 months more? There is a model code of conduct. The model code of conduct is intended to ensure that there should be no unfair advantage taken by any governmental decision, therefore any governmental department that could have a negative effect on an opposition party. That's the whole logic of the model code of conduct. What's happened here? You got two government departments, the ED and the CBI, taking steps that are intended directly to cripple the opposition parties. I'm sorry, one was the tax authorities, taking steps that are intended to cripple opposition parties. That too could have waited till the 4th of June. Is there anything going to go away with the 1993 tax returns of the Indian National Congress if you waited till the 4th of June? Is Mr. Kejriwal going to disappear from Delhi if you waited till the 4th of June? Whatever action you consider legitimate and legal, why could you not have waited till after the election? It's because you are losing. That's as simple an explanation as I can give you.
The third point that you raised about Kejriwal's arrest, do you think it has something to do with the electoral bonds, or it's a distraction strategy, or is it...
Well, I've been hearing this business of distraction for too long. The media generally has served the government as a weapon of mass distraction. Every time some uncomfortable story is in the public eye about the government, usually something happens to distract the media, and all the media start running discussions on these peripheral, marginal issues rather than on the genuine failings of the government. This we have seen time and time again in the last 10 years. So it could be one more example of that. But I don't think the electoral bonds are going away. A lot of people have shown starkly, and social media is full of analyses showing how starkly there is a correlation between companies being raided and then purchasing electoral bonds, companies purchasing electoral bonds and then being awarded contracts. One is nothing but extortion, the other is nothing but bribery. And the conviction that this has happened means, I'm afraid, that for some BJP leaders, it won't be Ab Ki Baar 400 Paar, it'll be Ab Ki Baar Tihar, because that's what these bonds are revealing to the Indian public.
Coming to your original point about the BJP having maxed out in the northern and central and western India. So do you think the Prime Minister, you know, he has made 4 visits to Kerala in this year itself. So do you think the BJP stands a chance of opening their account in Kerala? They started with Thrissur, then Pathanamthitta, but the Congress was very quick to dispatch K. Muralidharan to Thrissur, and Pathanamthitta, their choice of candidate seems to be absurd. So Thiruvananthapuram is the constituency that they are saying that they are going to win. So what do you say? What do you have to say?
Well, it certainly looks like it's the only one where they legitimately feel they have a chance. In fact, I'm told that their campaign manager from Pathanamthitta has already been sent back to Trivandrum. He's from here to campaign. I'm also told that that in Thrissur they've given up the ghost, that now my dear friend Suresh Gopi is trailing so badly in all the surveys and polls that it looks like he will get fewer votes than he won last time. It's become a two-horse race between the LDF and the UDF, as often happens in Kerala. So in these circumstances, the one quote-unquote genuine three-horse race in Kerala is supposed to be Thiruvananthapuram. But don't forget, we've all been in the fray now for a few weeks. The BJP and the LDF were faster than us in confirming candidates. I only started my campaign on the 10th when my name was announced. So I will say that as far as I'm aware, what I'm seeing from the general public, what I'm seeing from the reactions of people as I go through the constituency is very much a case of affection, of support, of goodwill that has been undimmed. And therefore, I'm not anticipating any big problems. my self-belief and self-confidence is intact. I don't think that either of the two contending parties is going to prevail this time.
Coming to your opponent, Rajiv Chandrasekhar.
I have two opponents, Anand. There's also a former MP for Thiruvananthapuram from the LDF.
Coming to your opponents, the first one, Rajiv Chandrasekhar, of course. You seem to have, you seem to indicate that, you know, you did not mind contesting against anybody, and that Rajiv Chandrasekhar would be as if you, you know, you seem to suggest that he's a pushover, but he hasn't, you know, turned out to be a pushover. He seems to be campaigning in full force.
I've never said anyone is a pushover. Sorry, Anand, that you won't find me ever making a comment like. I've just said anyone is welcome, because in a democracy, people need a choice. The whole point of democracy is to exercise a choice. So there should be candidates from both the parties here that fancy themselves as alternatives to me. And I'm perfectly willing to debate these candidates. They've shirked any opportunities to debate. So instead, they've all preferred to have individual interactions with the same channel rather than coming onto one podium to face me. Which I think is a shame, because I think I know what I'm talking about, and I don't think they do, but that's another matter. Having said that, I welcome them, but I'm not particularly perturbed by them. The challenge that that Mr. Rajiv Chandrasekhar faces is multiple. Number one is the fact that he has been a Rajya Sabha MP for 18 years from Karnataka, but has little or nothing to show for it. Other than his own business thriving, it's difficult to point to any accomplishments as an MP in the state he served for so long. Secondly, he's been IT minister for 2.5 years, and he's been certainly using that extensively in the technopark here, talking about all the IT miracles he's going to bring about. But in the 2.5 years he's been a minister of state in that ministry, he hasn't done a thing for technopark or Thiruvananthapuram. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, I'm not even sure he's been here, but even if he has been here, he hasn't done much. Third concern is that, yes, there is a message going around by his campaigners and perhaps from him, that if you vote for Tharoor, you'll get somebody in the opposition. If you vote for me, you'll get a minister who'll deliver all sorts of goodies to the city. And that may have influenced some of our voting elites. But as we said earlier in this conversation, is their government ever going to come back? Are they really thinking that they're going to have a minister coming from here? The sad truth for them is that there is going to be no BJP government from all the looks of it. If there was going to be one, they wouldn't be so desperate as to arrest Kejriwal, freeze the Congress bank accounts, and go desperately after allies whom they had once banished without much fanfare. So I think we're looking at a situation where they're in real panic. So the assurance that suddenly this guy is going to be a minister, I think, is going to start wearing thin as people start looking at the numbers and the stories coming out from the national campaign.
So, and coming to your other contender, Panniyan Ravindran of the CPI, he was a member of parliament. When you first came to contest, he was the sitting member of parliament. He did not contest in that election in 2009. He stepped away and now he has come back. How do you see his candidature? Do you think the CPI has put in their best possible contender against you? Or?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, he's a good man. I mean, no one has an unkind word to say about Panniyan Ravindran, because he's just genuinely a decent human being. I myself have seen him on and off in various occasions in the last 15 years as MP. He has often attended functions I've spoken at. We've spoken there. He's a cricket fan like me, so I've met him at the cricket stadium a couple of times in Thiruvananthapuram when we've had major matches and we've had a chance to talk. So he's been somebody I've had absolutely no problem with as an individual. The question is, how effective would he be in Delhi? How effective was he in his one term as MP? And why didn't he contest again? I think it's partially clear. It's because they felt that he didn't have much to show for his time in Delhi. And therefore, the question that comes up is, what can he offer that is better than what I can offer? They speak of secularism, we speak of secularism. But I've been a strong voice for India's diversity and pluralism inside and outside parliament on the national and international stage in ways that have counted. I can say with some immodesty about the number of people who tell me that when they travel anywhere in India and they say they're from Thiruvananthapuram, they immediately get the feedback, oh, this is Shashi Tharoor's place. And I'm flattered, because it wasn't my place 15 years ago, but now it is mine. I'm identified with it. I'm proud to be identified with it. I'm not sure that even a tenth of that impact is possible with a communist MP. The Communist Party doesn't have much of a strength nationally. And this election is about who's going to form the national government, who's going to be the national voice. Perhaps this very decent man should be given a chance to contest locally. in a local election or a state election, rather than being asked to take on a task which is already being performed for the people of Thiruvananthapuram better than perhaps he or his friends can.
You say that the BJP is not coming back, that the India Alliance probably has a better chance.
Yeah.
That's up to you to convince the voters. But as of now, Rajiv Chandrasekhar, as you admitted, is going around campaigning that if you vote for him, you're getting a minister. And then, the people he is appealing to, there's a similarity between your electorate, and that's the analysis, that he's appealing to the middle class, the Naya community, the women and the young voters. So he's appealing to them. So do you think, you know, are you at a risk of losing some of that, a portion of that, you know, voters that...
Perhaps a small portion of that. I certainly am not saying that the candidacy will not appeal to those who feel they can get things done through a minister more easily than through an opposition MP and so on. One is a realist about these matters. There is no MP in the country who wins 100% of the vote. Everybody is going to lose some votes to a candidate, and that may well be the case. But when you look at the mass appeal, my constituency is not just this elite, upper caste, highly educated, cosmopolitan, technocratic element that you say my BJP rival appeals to. My constituency, and I've won 3 times in a row, is also overwhelmingly the rural areas of the constituency, the coastal belt in the constituency, the tribal belt in the constituency. These are all places which I'm not even sure Mr. Chandrasekhar is aware of. He has come to the city of Thiruvananthapuram, but as he goes out and tries to engage with people in the rural areas, he'll see some very difficult and different challenges that they're living with and that I've been there for to help them with. I see, what I'm running on is on 2 things very simply, Anand, is my record for 15 years where I've delivered solution after solution for various problems. National Highway bypass, blocked for 14 years, log jammed. Government had laid marker stones on people's property and then not built the road for 40 years. And the message to me from my voters was, get the blessed road built or get the stones removed. We don't care if you drop the project, we can't continue like this. No one will buy our property, no one will give us a loan on because the government could take it over any time. And I did it. I saw them, this is during my first term, UPA government, got the highway ministers on board, got the National Highway Authority of India on board, got the finance minister on board, got the surveyors, got the survey done, got the gazette notification, even called the printing press to ensure that the 1 year period after which a survey lapses will not pass. Got it all done, and the first checks were handed over before the 2014 elections. So even the BJP goes around claiming credit for the road, the people know that I did it, and I did it before the BJP came to power. Though I will very happily give Mr. Gadkari credit for cooperating very well with us in seeing the road to completion, which only happened this year. And there, again, the MP had to be involved in intimate detail. There were 103 points on the road in which local communities had objections and problems. Somebody wanted an interchange, somebody wanted an overpass, somebody wanted an underpass. I had to go there, meet them, often attend protest rallies that have been called against the road, smooth out the feelings, bring the National Highway authorities to the location, work out a solution, go back, persuade Mr. Gadkari to approve it, and then it was done. That kind of thing, time after time after, it took 10 years. But the road is real now with the people's support, and that's something that really requires the kind of hands-on engagement that I've given them. That's only one example. I've been actively engaged in the port. I stood alone, even against my own party, on the modernization of Thiruvananthapuram International Airport. I have brought in, using all my personal connections, a UAE consulate here, a Sri Lankan consulate here. I have been able to bring railway stoppages to stations that had no additional train stopping in the last decades. 27 years in the case of Parashala, 40 years in the case of Karakutam, I was able to bring in stoppages by talking to railway officials, first in the UPA government, subsequently in the NDA government. So my point is, there is no area affecting people's daily lives that I've not been active in. Every week, about 250 petitions are addressed and dealt with. We've rescued people from difficult situations abroad. When they've been mugged or killed, or the bodies had to be repatriated, or urgent passports had to be issued, or whatever, we've been there for them. And frankly, during COVID, I'm very proud to say I was the first MP in India. Within hours of the COVID lockdown, I'd spent every penny in my remaining MP funds in getting PPE to the hospitals in Thiruvananthapuram, getting testing kits done.
2.5 crores from your MP Lads fund.
Absolutely. And it was done like this. In fact, in 3 days, the BJP government cut the MP LAD funds altogether and said, we will decide how to spend on COVID. But I had already spent my money, so at least it was only the following 2 years that I lost out on MP funds. But I believe that you're on the ground, you know what the needs are, you know what people want, you can act swiftly, and we did that. At that time, there were headlines in the papers saying, if you want an MP, this is the model kind of thing. And that people forget. Politics is a world of short-term memory, very short-term memories, and the even four-year-old, five-year-old memories are gone. But I will say that here, I have a record I'm proud of, and I know I can continue to offer the same quality of service, whether in government or whether in the opposition.
I think you already answered my question about the work that you have done, at least a significant portion of it. I was reading your report card, 70-page report card you released the other day, and you say many of these things in it, the bypass, about the port, about the railways, the airport, you say all those things. But if I may go back to your first point, I mean about the rural constituency that you have, and if I can connect it to Panni and Ravindran, you said Rajiv Chandrasekhar, it's true, you know, he can't appeal to the rural segment, the coastal segment beyond a point. But then I was in the coastal region yesterday. So after, you know, when the Vizhinjam strike happened, there were some issues that did not get sorted out, and I think that some feeling remains that they were let down in some way, that they have some kind of resentment. They may not vote against you, but some people said, we won't, you know, we are not active this time. We are not working for Dr. Tharoor. We worked for him last time, you know, very much. But we are not doing that this time because we feel let down. So why did that happen? And how
I can tell you why that happened. They feel let down because they had a 7-point charter of demands when they launched the agitation. I supported them on 6. I refused to support them on the 7th one, which is shut down the port.
Yeah.
I said, you can't shut down a port. First of all, it's a port in the national interest. But secondly, hundreds of crores of taxpayers' money have already been spent. You can't shut down if at all you had these concerns, the time to voice them was before the project starts. Whereas it's precisely the coastal communities that had demanded of me. I didn't know anything about Vizhinjam when I first came. It was they who demanded of me that this project must come, that it's a dream project for the development of the area. Environmental studies were done. Jairam Ramesh was the environment minister, so he knew he's serious about these matters. Everything was done, and then the project was launched. Now it turns out that they feel that their livelihoods have been affected. But I had already, when the Congress government was in power in the state under Uman Chande as chief minister, I had already demanded that adequate compensation should be paid for all those who had lost livelihoods or income, or even in some cases homes, because of the consequences of the port. And the chief minister had fully agreed. I'm a member at his invitation of the board of directors of the William Seaport Limited. And the chief minister then, the Congress chief minister, had approved in his cabinet and put into the budget a 475 crore, 476 crore, I think, or 78.
478
crore package of compensation for everyone. Very sadly, he lost the subsequent election and the new government has refused to honor his word. So the real bitterness people feel is they didn't get the compensation. I think had they received compensation fairly, they would not be so anxious to shut the port down. Because the attitude is the sport is not doing us any good because we never got any compensation for it. And that's why they feel let down. And this is something where I have a strong feeling because I've been one MP who has batted for the coastal community throughout the last 15 years. For example, when Cyclone Oki happened, the morning the storm broke, I went to Poontara Parish Hall and sat there with the chief minister who also came. And then we sat down together. I made all the calls from my mobile phone, calling Mr. Gadkari, who was then Minister of Shipping, asking him to send a message out, distress all our fishermen out at sea who were in distress because of the cyclone. I'm the one who spoke to the naval commander asking for the same favor. I'm the one who spoke to the Coast Guard commander asking what he could do. I'm the one who spoke to the finance minister saying anything that came under her purview, could she please come in? I called them all the morning of. I was in the Poontara Parish Hall from 9:30 to 4:30 doing nothing but this. Subsequently, when the cyclone was over, I did two things that, again, you know, it's very easy for somebody who wasn't here in those days, like Mr. Chandrasekhar, to say, I've never been there, never done anything. But I'm telling you what I've done. I not only visited every single home that had suffered any loss, either of boats, of people, of lives, or of shelter, 136 homes I personally visited in 2 or 3 successive weekends to condole them. And I fought in Delhi to increase the compensation which had been first announced by the NDA government. The compensation announced for Cyclone Oki was so trivial and minor. I went and saw the Prime Minister himself, as well as others, during the Parliament session to say we must give more. And I must say, a much more generous package was given. And the people know this. The people who are actually involved in working with me know this. There'll always be others who will complain, agitate, and so on. But I have stood by that community. I've also raised the issues of the coastal people, particularly sea erosion, in every possible forum. I have made about 20 speeches in Parliament mentioning this under Rule 377, which is the urgent matters of public importance, under Zero Hour, under Question Hour, in the budget speeches that I've been making on behalf of my party. I have constantly pushed the cause of the fisher folk and the coastal communities. And I've written to the Prime Minister saying, if China came, or a foreign country, I said, official letter, came and took 6 feet of our land, we would make it a national issue. The whole nation would rise up against it. Mm. I have lost not a few feet, but 64 square kilometers of Indian territory. Mm. Bharat Mata's territory has gone because of sea erosion, and no one is willing to find any money to solve it. And what I'm getting as a reply is the central government saying, sorry, shoreline protection is a state government's responsibility. And the state government saying, sorry, we're broke, we can't do it. So this constant buck passing doesn't work. Now, Mr. Chandrasekhar comes and brings a letter from a PS. I have letters from ministers. I have a reply on behalf of the Prime Minister. I have written answers to questions asked in the Lok Sabha. He brings a letter from a PS to a minister saying, I found a solution. And what does his letter show? Number one, that the government will offer technical assistance. Sorry, we don't need technical assistance. We need money. Everyone knows how to build a seawall or a groin, as it's called. We don't need technical assistance. Second point, it says, we will do a DPR. Well, I'm sorry, the government has made that promise to me 13 months ago in a written answer from the Lok Sabha, which I've also published, saying we will do a DPR. 13 months later, there is still no DPR. Mr. Chandrasekhar comes with a letter from a PS, not even from a minister. I got an answer from a minister. He's saying that they'll do a DPR, and the DPR, frankly, is not required because the state government has finally come up with a project of 346 crores or something like that, of which they want the centre to provide 200 crores. And the center has not provided one paisa yet. So the bottom line is, neither government in the state nor in the center is taking its responsibility seriously. And each says it's the other party's responsibility. Neither has found any money for this. And that is the problem that genuinely affects the people. Even then, even though 2 years of MP funds were cut, I spent 1.5 crores of MP funds building seawalls in some areas, 2 villages in Poyyur, 1 village in Kochitop, and those are the only areas that have stayed free from sea erosion. However, in other areas, there has been more erosion, and so some people wrongly feel that the MP could have done more. I've done everything I could. They have an MLA who could have done more because there's 6 crores a year that the Kerala MLAs get, whereas I get the equivalent of 50 lakhs because I get 5 crores for 7 assembly constituencies, less 25% for SCST projects. That leaves me 3.5 crores for 7 constituencies, 50 lakhs per constituency. I can't build miracles. It takes literally dozens of crores to build a few seawalls in this area. Mm. Something the government should do and isn't doing.
So you're saying that the Pinarayi Vijayan government did not carry on with the 478 crore package that was announced by Umman Chandy.
Correct.
And your progress report says 67 homes have been rebuilt, or they have been rehabilitated, 67 families. Then the Rajiv Awas Yojana, you mentioned there are some...
That's over. That was brought by me in my first term to rehabilitate some of the areas in Vizhinjam, which are occupied principally by one community, not the Latin Catholic community that accounts for the majority of the fishing community further up on the coast. But that project did proceed, except that when the BJP came to power, they cancelled the project.
In 2022?
Yeah. Well, no, they cancelled it earlier in their first term. I begged that at least an ongoing project should not be left unfinished. They should complete it. And the then minister concerned, Hardeep Puri, did agree. And so what was begun was completed. So 1,372 dwelling units for people were constructed under the Rajiv Awas Yojana. But subsequently, they've scrapped the scheme altogether. And so there isn't at the moment a scheme to rehabilitate people sufficiently who've lost their homes. At the moment, the state government is housing some people in inhuman conditions in old godowns.
Warehouses.
Which I've gone and seen, they're terrible. And in those circumstances, I do believe there should be much more effort made. But for everything, the answer with this Kerala government is they don't have money. A poor old 76-year-old widow went to court 3 weeks ago saying, I haven't had a pension for 3 months, how do I live?
Six months.
The state government was unashamedly saying, we don't have money to pay her pension. And they have money for every single lavish expenditure of the government, including everything that benefits CPM cadres, but they won't look after the people of the state and particularly of the coastal communities. But that's for another election. That's for the state assembly elections 2 years from now. Right now, whatever an MP can do, I have done. I'm willing to continue doing it. It's up to the voters to decide how they feel about what I have done and what's enough or not enough for them.
So you mentioned about these packages in your progress report. What was the figure of the central government, the package that was given to this from the central government to the
Congress? So the state government has asked for the centre to contribute 200 crores of a 346 crore package. At the moment, according to everything we've heard from the centre, they have not even formally received a request from the state government, which shows a certain level of insincerity on the state government's part as well. They've announced it in the media a couple of weeks ago that they've come up with a request for a proposal, a DPR, to strengthen the shoreline in all these areas. Just in time for the elections, they made this announcement. But they have not officially submitted a request to the central government, as far as the central government claims. Now, I can't now go into all of this because the elections are on. But as of when the elections were announced, the central government was claiming they had no request from the state government. People have to realize when MP goes and asks, the MP is an individual. Where the things work best is when a state government asks and the MP lobbies in Delhi in support of an official request, which I'm very happy to do. I've done it for lots of things. Flood relief, cyclone relief, central road funds, everything. But central government says, let the request come from the state government, then we'll see. I can give you another example. There is a lake in Thiruvananthapuram with fresh water called Valayani, which is a major source of drinking supply and so on. There's a massive amount of weed infestation. I even, 1 year, spent some NP funds to try and get people to clear the weeds. The lake is shrinking as a result. Drinking water supplies are in peril. There is a scheme in the central government for which they can rejuvenate and rescue the freshwater lake. I asked a question in Parliament. The minister said, we've not received a request from the state government. I immediately wrote to the Chief Minister, Mr. Pinarayi Vijayan, saying, this is the question I asked in Parliament. This is the answer I got. Please make a request. They have money. They should be able to help. And I can fight to get that money for my constituency. I didn't even get a reply from the state government. To this day, years later, there is no request from the state government under the scheme. So when you have an inefficient, helpless government that is only interested in strengthening its own political party and scoring political points on the cheap, and you have a central government that basically sits on its hands and says, it's the state government's problem, how do you get anything done?
So the sense that I got, the people of the coastal people, they are angry at the state government and they never vote for the BJP, but they say that okay, Panin Ravindran, he's not from the CPM, he's from the CPI and he's a common man, you know, he comes and he mingles with us, he's just like one of us, we don't mind voting for him. But the state government now, very recently they started withdrawing the cases registered during the Virginia protests, so they are also trying to, you know, appeal to the electorate, the coastal belt, to vote for them, vote for Panin Ravindran. So do you fear some part of that vote switching, you know, the coastal votes?
I'm not sure. I mean, he's, as I said, he's a very nice man and people like him and so on. But how effective can he be in Delhi is the question that people will be asking. So yes, if some people do want to vote for him, it's entirely their privilege. But you know, the question is this a beauty contest? Is this a who is likable, who is like us? Or is it a contest about who can be effective in fighting for us in Delhi? That's the issue.
Okay, so coming to certain points in your progress report, you mentioned how you supported Technopark, you brought Tech Mahindra, Oracle companies to the Technopark.
Nissan,
Ernst
& Young.
Yeah, and Ernst & Young.
And Taurus.
Taurus, yes, it's mentioned in. So, you know, there's a large-scale migration of young people from Kerala abroad. You're the sitting MP from Thiruvananthapuram. You also are probably an aspirant to chief ministership, or if the UDF comes to power next time. So you must have an answer. You must have an answer to this issue. Why is this happening and how it can be stopped? And as you say, you know, is it possible to open? What is the solution that you can offer them?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is to ensure that Kerala sheds its reputation for being God's own country for tourists and the devil's own backyard for business. The truth is, it takes 3 days in Singapore and the US to open a business. India, the average is 114 days. In Kerala, it's 236 days. Why does it need to be so? Why are we encumbered with so many regulations, procedures, clearances, levels of bureaucracy to approve everything? Why do we do this? We are shooting ourselves in the foot. I've tried for a brief period between leaving the UN and entering politics to try and lobby for the state. I had no politics at that time. It was a CPM government in power, but I still helped them. When the then Industries Minister Elamaram Karim came to New York, I organized a dinner at my expense for him to meet investors. We had about 40 investors at a dinner at an Indian restaurant. The problem is, at the end of it all, not one of them invested. They say they simply don't trust Kerala because of the state's reputation for being heavily politicized. These red flags will show up the moment you try and do anything. So I said, but you know, Malayali workers are educated, able, energetic, etc. Why don't you do that? They said, if we just establish the same factory across the border in Tamil Nadu, we won't have any of the political problems and we get the same Malayali workers crossing the border to work for us. That's the kind of challenge I'm facing. So what I would say to Kerala is, let's give young people the opportunity to stay here by enhancing business opportunities, slashing the regulations, and simplifying clearances so people have an incentive to do that. Secondly, we need to double down on the areas we are good at. That includes, of course, tourism, that includes the hospitality industry generally. It includes the wellness industry, Ayurveda in particular, but also other traditional practices. And of course, it includes IT, where we had the first technopark in India way back in 1992, but it simply never attracted the kind of business over the year. When I came in 2007 already, it was languishing. And that's one of the reasons I focused so much on Technopark. When I came, there were 17,500 people working at Technopark. Today, there's about 70,000. I'm not saying I brought them all, but I'm certainly a major contributory factor in enhancing the quality of the companies that have come in and the number of companies that have come in. Yes, this is an area which I think has a lot of potential, as my BJP rival is also pointing to. But the point is, getting it done requires a kind of diligence and persistence and track record that I can demonstrate and that at the moment nobody else can.
Do you think it's been the bane of, the CPM's trade union culture seeping into every area?
I'm strongly in favor of trade unions, but you know, INTUC, the Congress trade union, has a charter that's very responsible, that talks about labor rights that don't impinge upon the rights of businesses to do well and thrive. Unfortunately, the CPM's culture is very different. They essentially don't allow people to make a profit and to function perfectly. Whereas the INTC sees itself as standing up for labor rights in the context of businesses doing well. There's a very big difference in the culture of the INTC and the CITU, the communist trade unions. So I am very much in favor of labor rights. I don't want labor to be exploited. I want,
but
in fact,
there are no unions in the IT industry, for instance.
That may be for specific historical reasons. And IT is not an easy place to unionize because it's overwhelmingly technocrats and professionals who work there. Whereas, say, in a factory, you have a thin veneer of managers and you have a large number of labor. So it's naturally where the majority...
Do you think Kerala is the place for setting up factories? Because nobody does these menial jobs. We have people coming all over from Odisha, from Bengal, from the north, doing these jobs. And we have people doing the same jobs. People from Kerala, they'll go rather to the Gulf countries or the...
All I'm saying is, of course, there are some things that do employ a lot of labor and labor rights are important. I'm not advocating right now the heavy industrialization of the state because we probably missed that bus.
Yes.
But I'm encouraging businesses in areas that young people graduating from the state can do in this state without feeling they need to go elsewhere, in other states or other countries, in order to find decent employment. In an ecosystem where new businesses are coming up all the time, there will be various kinds of employment. There are people leaving us and going to the Gulf countries to be shop assistants, store clerks, you know, logistics managers. Jobs that we would have if we had more business activity, all these would be multiplying opportunities here too. Retail industry, more online businesses coming up, but then that requires people to deliver. You've got a whole variety of things that are not yet strongly developed in Kerala that can be. Tourism, Vizhinjam, for example, we could easily add a cruise terminal and start cruises from Vizhinjam going northwards.
Okay.
Imagine Vizhinjam to Kochi to Goa, for example, or Mangalore on the way and then Mumbai, Goa. Maybe even Mumbai, but Mumbai, of course, the docks, I'm not quite sure what the circumstances are there for cruises, but whatever it may be, we have to do more research. But there's so many things we could do that we've not done so far. And that would have to be part of the message. If we are so environmentally friendly, why not much more ecological tourism, for example? So there are things we can do and we can make an effort. It requires imagination, but it also requires making it easier for businesses to risk their money here. I was the first one, the only one, as far as I know, to advocate an Investor Protection Act for Kerala that would guarantee that while anybody can't be protected against business losses, they certainly can be protected against the whims of the government, the bureaucracy, the trade unions and the politicians who have otherwise actually caused serious losses to investors. I've often pointed out very ruefully, in many states in India, there have been farmer suicides. But Kerala is the only state in India where there have been two investor suicides. People coming in, sinking their life savings into a business in the state and then finding completely unwarranted obstacles when they start there. After they've invested money in land, factory, premises, whatever it may be, there'll be red flags, there'll be bureaucratic objections, there'll be court cases, all frivolous, but enough to destroy them. And this is why two businessmen that we know have committed suicide. So in these circumstances, a more investor-friendly Kerala will be a place that will retain talent rather than lose it.
My next question is two-pronged. You have pending the High Court bench, Light Metro, AIIMS in Trivandrum, Shipyard in Goa. These are your, you know, the things that you want in the pipeline. You have in the pipeline.
No, these are things I have pursued and not succeeded for reasons that have been explained in my report.
Yes.
The High Court bench can only come with the consent of the Chief Justice of the state.
Yes.
And though I was able to speak to individual Chief Justices, they all said they need the consent themselves of the majority of other judges, otherwise they speak for an institution, not as individuals. And at every stage, that consent has not been forthcoming. I even persuaded one of our Chief Justices to set up a committee of judges to give her advice on how to take this forward. And that committee of judges could not agree amongst themselves and the idea failed. When this failed, I tried the only other possible route, which is to try and get a law passed. I introduced a private member's bill that said that any state capital that doesn't have a High Court bench will have one by law, which bypasses the objections of some judges. But the BJP government was not prepared to take up this bill. I went and saw the law minister of the day, who told me very bluntly that they will not do it. And when I said, why not? He said very simply, because we feel it will antagonize the judiciary and we don't want to do that. Now, I'm not sure it would antagonize the judiciary. It's some judges who, for their own convenience, would prefer to remain in Kochi than to travel periodically to have a bench in Thiruvananthapuram. But it seems to me that when you look at the fact that the bulk of the cases in the High Court, in the Kerala High Court, are cases involving the government. And so officials are constantly traveling to Kochi, getting TADA to the tune of 3 crore rupees a year, just in travel expenses and back
wasteful
and forth,
expenses,
as well as their absence from their offices and so on. It is one of the most inefficient things for a state capital not to have a High Court bench. There are only three state capitals in the entire country that don't have a High Court bench. One is Odisha, but then Bhubaneswar and Katak are just 30 kilometers away from each other, so they don't need one.
Yeah.
It's only a 30-kilometer drive. The other is Bhopal, but there are four High Court benches across Madhya Pradesh.
Mm.
And the final one is us in Kerala, where the nearest place to the capital that has a High Court is Kochi, and that's 6.5 hours away by road. And of course, a short flight, but very, very often people go by road. So the results we are facing, and there is only one flight a day anyway.
Mm.
So you're looking at a situation where it's inefficient, it's expensive, it's wasteful not to have a High Court bench in the state capital.
My other question, which was related to this, is these are big ticket projects. And some people say that there is a sense of water fatigue after 15 years. So do you have projects, do you have plans to appeal to them that you have, you still have many things to offer? You've invested quite, I've seen your MPLAT funds, you know, how you've utilized it. You've invested in sports, in hospitals, in high mast lights, so many other things.
Shelters, Anganwadis, COVID, and the seawalls and the coasts are done.
So
everything.
What do you have to basically say to those people who say that there's a 15-year, you know, itch or whatever it is, you know, fatigue or sentence? What do you have to say to that?
Well, two things. Number one, you've had service, for example, when unexpected crises arose, like Oki, like the floods, like the cyclone thing and the COVID disaster. Every time you had somebody who was able to respond and serve your interests. So the next crisis that comes along, would you rather have a safe pair of hands or somebody untested who may not bother about you. That's one question. The second thing is, don't forget an MP's job is not only development. In fact, the MP has very little money for development. So I can only be involved in very, very small scale projects for the most part. But the MP's job is to speak for you in Parliament, yes, to bat for the state, to bat for your idea of India. What kind of India do you want to live in? That's what the Lok Sabha election is about. And there, if you agree with what I stand for, which is for India's diversity, pluralism and secularism, versus what the other gentleman stands for, which is communalism, Hindi, Hindutva, Hindustan is the slogan of their party, and the Hindu Rashtra is their avowed goal, choose. Who would you rather represent? If you think that you share those goals, by all means vote for the candidate whose party espouses those goals. If you don't share those goals, vote for somebody who will bat for your values.
I was coming to your performance in the parliament. You introduced 13 private members' bills, the asylum bill particularly, in 2014, again in 2021. Now the government, the NDA government has, they have regularized, they have brought the
CAA.
Yeah,
but that's not the same as giving asylum.
Yeah, but do you think, but it's without the NRC now. There's no National Register of Citizens.
So far. But as Mr. Amit Shah famously said in the Lok Sabha, I was there.
Chronology
samjhiye.
Yeah. So are you anticipating that for later, or you think this is going to be, a refugee policy in itself or something of that kind?
No, this is not a refugee policy.
Discrimination.
A refugee policy would be that you would give asylum on the basis of a proper hearing and a proper process to anyone from another country who fears persecution on the grounds of race, nationality, gender, sexual orientation, political opinion, that kind of factor. And any of those things qualify, and there is no exclusion on the grounds of religion, as the CAA brings in. This our government has been unwilling to do. And perhaps it's going to take someone like an enlightened Congress Prime Minister to realize the value of not being the only democracy in the world not to have a refugee and asylum law.
Why did it not happen earlier? I mean,
I only came into politics in 2009, so don't blame me. And it wasn't my portfolio, but I did mention it to a couple of people, including the then Home Minister. But the thing is that by the time I sort of got on top of all these issues here, we lost power and we were not in a position to deliver something like this. I will certainly bat for this in a new government, no question about it. But having said that, the problem also is one of is a conceptual problem. Are you talking about introducing religion as an element in citizenship? Because if so, you're betraying the freedom struggle, which the country was divided because one set of people said religion is our determinant of our nationhood, and they created Pakistan. What remained from Mahatma Gandhi, all the leaders and what remained, Jawaharlal Nehru, Dr. Ambedkar, Maulana Azad, they all said, no, the freedom struggle was for everybody and we will create a country for everybody. And they wrote a constitution that enshrines in Article 14 the principle of equality, that enshrines in Article 25 to 29 the principle of religious freedom and worship and equality. Now, when you've got that and you've got a government that says we will exclude people of one religion, it's an assault on the basic structure of the constitution, the fundamental assumptions of the freedom struggle. It seems to me it has to be opposed, and I'm proud I opposed it. I will continue opposing it. Yep. If we can replace that CAA with a law that applies to everybody, there won't be too many cases, frankly, of Muslims from neighboring countries seeking refuge in India. But there will be people, and there have been people, who because of their political opinions were persecuted in those countries and seek refuge in India. Why should they be ineligible? Why should only people of certain specified religions be eligible?
You have made private members, you have introduced private members' bills. You have spoken at large about you have made interventions on the UAPA,
the amendment they brought in, which gives them the right to essentially call anyone a terrorist, yes, and then detain him without charge for indefinite periods of time without charge or bail.
Now,
that's wrong.
Now,
I had to intervene on that.
My question is, you've made interventions on CAA, on UAPA, but the state government in Kerala somehow seems to suggest that the Congress MPs and, they're all useless. They don't make...
It shows a certain contempt for the knowledge of the voter that they would blatantly lie when a two-minute search on Google will find you the truth. All my speeches in Parliament are on YouTube. All the stands I've taken are available. My positions are also available in articles that were reported at the time that I took these positions. It's preposterous to brazenly lie like this. But the chief minister, sadly, either doesn't have a staff member who can go on YouTube and tell him the truth, or feels that he can lie because, unfortunately, information in today's world is more and more in silos. And people of the communist ecosystem only hear communist views. They'll never hear anybody else's view. And the PJP and the BJP ecosystem only hearing BJP views. And it's only the Congress that is fair-minded and listens to everyone's views. That's a pretty disastrous situation for our democracy. But I can tell you that we are robustly denying the charge of the chief minister that we have not taken stands on these issues, because we have, and the evidence is there.
Yes. And, you know, your famous words, India matters to me, I would like to matter to India. So do you see, this is going to be a fourth contest, and if you're winning this time, and would you see contesting again, or running a fifth time, or could it be your last election?
I think it'll almost certainly be my last election.
Are you going to announce
one can
that?
Never say, no, I did announce it in an interview in a Malayalam channel.
But never say never.
And I also said never say never, because the truth is, in politics you can't. Who knows what circumstance there might be a national situation that demands my continued involvement. I don't know. But in the normal course, if it continues the way it has been for the last 10, 15 years, I will feel that I have been as useful as I could be. I've done my contribution, and it's time to make way for someone younger. And I think in the context of Thiruvananthapuram politics, maybe also someone from a different community should be given a chance. So all of these factors would be there. Having said that, I'm not ruling out staying involved in politics. There are, after all, it's not only through the Lok Sabha that you can
be
involved.
You want to switch? Do you foresee a switch to state politics?
Look, I'm not ruling anything out. As I've said, never say never. But right now, I'm running for the Lok Sabha, and my interest is in winning the seat and representing, as I have done so far, the people of Thiruvananthapuram.
So looking back at your 15-year career as an MP, how do you rate yourself? You know, do you see that, you know, when you came into politics, you said it was probably a bit too late. You wanted to come in earlier, sooner, at a younger age. Now, after 15 years, do you see that you have reached your goals, the goals that you set in earlier from 2009 to 14, then another two terms? How do you rate your...
Look, when I first came in, my only ambition was to be a good MP and figure out the rest of politics on the way. I believe I have been a good and effective MP, and that's why I'm willing to continue in that role. Everything else, the opportunities I may have had or may not have had, those are incidental. They're the icing on the cake. Ultimately, what I've achieved so far has principally been linked to my parliamentary performance and my role as an MP for the people here. And yes, I would say for my ability to move the needle on the national conversation on some fairly major issues, where my voice has actually affected the terms of discourse and the terms of debate on everything from my book on British colonialism.
But do you think the Congress Party has utilized you properly as much as they could have done?
I think that's a debate for others to judge, not for me. I have certainly been available whenever the Congress Party has needed me, and I'm honored they've made me a member of the Working Committee, which is their highest body. And I will continue playing my role in the Congress Party. Most recently, I was a member of the Manifesto Committee for these elections. So all of these ways, I'm contributing as best I can. And I'm not here to express any dissatisfaction. I'm here soldiering on. And if at all one day I decide to throw in the towel, I'll tell you why, but not yet.
Yes. And, the running for Congress president. So that's a part of the question. So do you think you've become more acceptable to the Congress cadre, the Congress leaders, the opposition? I mean, initially, you had many people opposing your entry, your lateral entry to Congress in Thiruvananthapuram itself, not to speak of the rest of Kerala. So do you think you won them over after contesting, not before the contest, but at least after you won 1,000 plus votes after contesting, and now you're part of the CWC, as you said?
Yeah, no, I've always felt that I had a strong support base within my party. I've also been conscious not everyone sees me that way, but that's life. I don't think anyone in politics attracts unanimity, anyone, within parties or across parties. For me, therefore, the only yardstick that matters is, do the voters still want to place their confidence in me? Three times they've done so. I'm hoping they will do so a fourth time. That's the only meaningful yardstick to answer your question.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tharu, for taking your time out from your busy schedule, your campaigning. Thank you very much for speaking to The Print.
Thank you, Anand. All the best.
Thank you.